calls for gun reform grow louder after a string of mass shootings. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, will Congress and the President act? We will take your calls and talk about it right now. Get on the line. It's 549-2937. Then later, how local veterans are seeking help and support this week for the health impacts of Agent Orange. That and more just ahead this morning. But first this hour, three mass shootings in under a week in different cities across the country have the nation reeling. As cries for gun reform grow louder, President Trump this morning is also now calling for stronger background checks on gun purchases. There have been 251 mass shootings in the U.S. this year so far. Here with his thoughts, we welcome Daniel Cronrath. He's professor of political science at FSCJ. He's also the former regional director for Mayors Against Illegal Guns. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And let us know your thoughts about the mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio over the weekend, and the new calls to pass gun reform legislation in Congress, including from the president. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And let's begin, Daniel, with your thoughts on President Trump's remarks this morning on Twitter. He tweeted that after the deadly shooting rampage in El Paso, Texas, and then another one 13 hours later in Dayton, Ohio, he's calling for pairing gun control legislation with immigration reform. What's your reaction to that?
Well, First of all, I think they're two completely different issues, even though I think that a lot of us can appreciate that the president is taking an interest in this, especially after the tragedy of the weekend. Let's be very, very clear that, you know, the kind of gun violence that we're having in the United States right now and the kind of relative to these mass shootings, linking that to immigration, I think, is a very, very interesting choice by the president, since the two aren't related to each other at all. But it's advancing his political agenda while he's also responding to a need of the moment. To be more positive, I'm glad the president's saying these things. But Melissa, we've seen this before. How will the president of the United States come out once the NRA has gotten a hold of him and they've put him in a room for a couple of days and he has conservative lawmakers who start to talk to him and talk back? We lived this in Florida after Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, when we all thought we were going to have a lot of momentum. The kids from Parkland, we became a national movement with March for Our Lives. And then lo and behold, at the end of the day, we basically did nothing except increase the age that you can buy an assault style weapon 3 years. And that was it. That was the end of our public policy discussion here in the state outside of hardening schools. So, you know, that initial reaction by the president, how does it actually equate into action as the weeks go on?
It's 549-2937 to join us now. You mentioned the push for changes to gun laws in Florida. There is a push in this state to get a constitutional amendment on the Florida ballot in 2020 that would effectively ban assault weapons in Florida. Attorney General Ashley Moody is fighting this proposed assault weapons ban in the state. She is appearing here in Jacksonville this week. There is a high bar to get the number of petitions the advocates would need to get this before the voters. The state Supreme Court is looking at this, but that is just one example of the contentiousness of this issue when you bring it down here to the state level in Florida. And let me ask you, as a follow-up, how does Florida rank in terms of the ease of getting weapons, obtaining weapons, compared to other parts of the country? For example, the shooter in Dayton, Ohio, we learned he bought his weapon in Texas. It had 100-round drums, legal in the state of Ohio. Mm-hmm. The shooter in Texas used an assault-style rifle as well, legal in the state of Texas. Legally, he was allowed to walk into the Walmart with that weapon as an open carry, but only until he started using it did he break the law. And so states vary in terms of their gun legislation. How does Florida compare?
We are a lax gun law state when it comes to actually purchasing a firearm, Melissa. Now, we do have a lot of strict penalties in place for the criminal use of a firearm. If you break the law, if you're a felon caught, for example, with a firearm, you're going to have a minimum mandatory sentence. We take those things on the criminal side very seriously. But in terms of us being able to go ahead and purchase a gun, it's very, very easy. You know, you can walk into a Walmart if you have an ID and you're over the age of 21, and you can basically buy and carry that day. providing that you pass your national instant criminal background check system. Unlike other states, you know, we don't, for example, in private sales, we haven't moved as a state in closing what people refer to as the gun show loophole, which is really better referred to as the private sale loophole, meaning if you were an individual, you can, with no questions asked, you can sell me any kind of the gun out of the back of your car if you wanted to, Melissa. It's just that simple because you're not a federal firearm dealer. Of course, we have stronger restrictions in the state of Florida if you were to go to a gun gallery or shooter or a local retailer than what we do for private sales. So, and also too, Florida, just for information for the viewers, is also at the end of what we call the Iron Pipeline, which is I-95, the corridor running all up and down the United States. There are a lot of firearms that are purchased in the state of Florida that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms will tell you move from Florida because it's easy to buy here, and they end up at northeastern states that actually have much more stringent laws. So I think one of the things we need to look at first is when folks would say, well, Chicago has some of the toughest gun laws in the country, but they have all of these gun crimes. Well, it's not as if guns and people don't move. You know, you can easily buy a firearm in the state of Illinois and take it to Chicago, or buy a firearm in Texas and take it to Dayton. It's you know, folks move and guns move with them.
That brings up the increasingly loud calls for federal legislation. Measures have passed the U.S. House of Representatives. They will not be taken up in the Senate. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has said he won't move this legislation through the Senate. And I think that is behind some of the frustration you're seeing around the country, Daniel, because there is widespread popular support for measures like increased background checks, closing the gun show loophole. Mm. The majority of Americans polled over the last couple of years say, in general, they want more restrictive gun laws, roughly two-thirds of Americans. The politics of this, though, have become unbelievably difficult, and they've been that way for a very long time. Let's talk about that. Put your political science professor hat on.
Sure. As I would tell my students, you know, I think that the most powerful lobby we have in the United States relative to its actual size and import is the National Rifle Association. Nowhere are you going to find an organization with fewer members who actually this last year have been in a complete state of disarray with their leadership, who continue to wield this much power in the halls of Congress. That is why the Senate will not take up these kinds of bills. Let's just be honest about it. These folks who are elected officials fear their money. They fear being primaried. They feel the NRA report card, which is if you are an NRA member and you get that in the mail and you see, you know, that you're either an A or a B. This is very important for folks in conservative districts to get reelected. It's to the point now the NRA is so polarizing that if you'll recall in the when Clinton and Bernie Sanders were running in 2016, they were bragging about having a D minus and an F respectively from the NRA. So let's get to the root of this. If you look at NRA members themselves, I'm not talking about self-identified Republicans or conservatives, over 70% of them now, NRA members support universal background checks when we buy a gun. So you really have an organization which is masquerading as a nonprofit organization, a civil liberties organization, which is representing gun manufacturers. That's what they're doing. This the organization that my family was a member of when we were growing up and we were in a hunting family that was trying to protect public lands and trying to be conservationist, that organization is gone. It doesn't exist in the way that we knew it to exist. It is a lobbying arm of the gun manufacturers, and we need to start there. That's our first place in our public policy discussions.
What's your reaction to a new report this morning in the New York Times looking at the growing impact of another lobby group battling the NRA, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, primarily a grassroots group formed by local mothers, including a mother from this area, Lucy McBath. She lost her son, Jordan Davis, here in Jacksonville to gun violence. She's now a member of Congress, motivated primarily by this issue. Mm-hmm. How do you see the grassroots effort to push for stricter gun regulations taking on the gun lobby?
I think it can do it by volume. I think that a couple of things would have to happen, in my opinion. I think, one, you would have to find the pro-gun control movement in the United States, find one group to coalesce around. There's a bunch of folks out there who are trying to do good work. Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which was started by Michael Bloomberg, that Mayor Payton was involved in for a while here in Jacksonville. One is part of the Jacksonville journey. We were looking for ways as a community to say, okay, some folks like guns and they believe in gun ownership. Some don't. How can we come together? Of course, that left when Bloomberg left office. But I think that would be the first thing, is taking an organization like you mentioned with citizen advocates who then are getting elected to Congress. So now you're a citizen advocate with power. political power, and getting them to basically everyone else to coalesce around these groups so you have a unified message, okay? And something that you can use as a way to buttress the power of the NRA, to raise money, to start running ads like the NRA would run ads, okay? And really start to fight back in ways which are tangible.
The first mass shooting in America, people might not realize, happened in Jacksonville, Florida. It was at the GMAC building on Bay Meadows Road. Mm-hmm. We had a mass shooting here last year at the Jacksonville Landing. So this issue has touched the First Coast. At the same time, you know, school is starting up again for many families in Northeast Florida next week. Parents are concerned about the safety of their kids. Bulletproof backpacks are even being sold in this area now. What about the concerns of parents and kids?
I wish I had more to say there. I mean, I think that the efforts that the legislature has taken in some regard, not to necessarily arm teachers, which as a classroom teacher is a matter of personal opinion, I'm opposed to, again, my personal opinion. But I think the taking and hardening of our schools is a good step. But, you know, Melissa, it's very disconcerting. I mean, whether it's our schools, whether it's a country music concert, whether it's a nightclub, whether it's a church in South Carolina in Charleston, you know, there's just really no place now left in the United States that this issue can't touch any of us when we're least expecting it.
The randomness of it, I think, is what is so frightening for so many people, including gun owners and members of the NRA. Let me ask you as a follow-up, and then we'll go to some calls. Most of the mass shootings in this country have been committed by young white men.
Yeah.
A high percentage of them have ties to the white nationalist extremist movement in America, mm-hmm. primarily connecting online. Back in May, the president appeared at a rally here in Florida and was talking about how to stop people crossing the border. Someone in the audience yelled out, "Shoot them." Here was the president's response.
"But how do you stop these people? You can't. There's no..." That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement. Only in the panhandle.
Okay, the president joking about shooting migrants crossing the border. He has come under heavy criticism as we learned that the shooter that killed dozens of people in El Paso, Texas, was motivated by fears of what extremist groups online call white replacement or darker skinned people coming into, in their words, invading this country and replacing white people. Mm-hmm. How much responsibility do you think the president bears for this kind of rhetoric leading to deadly violence?
In my opinion, I think the president needs to bear responsibility for the steps he's taking to heal the country. We have had, you know, really our first high-profile mass murder was Eric Harris back in Columbine in 1999, and we remember that shooting. And since then, we've had just an increase in mass shooters, all with that demographic that you just profiled, Melissa. So they've been with us. They were with us through the Bush administration, the Obama administration. Where I think that this president is doing our nation a tremendous disservice is that typically you want the president of the United States to be leading with positivity, safety, how we correct this problem, not with encouraging lawlessness, even if it's in jest. There is nothing positive about those kinds of remarks when we know now for a fact that there is a very, very small percentage of the population that are hearing his words and are somehow, maybe they would commit these crimes anyway, okay? But they still have it in the back of their mind that the president of the United States is somehow condoning their activity. And what is the illness of their mind? We need a president and we need a Congress right now who are going to be leading us through this with practical solutions and casting aside the political influences of the NRA and other people in the hard right and saying, listen, we need to approach this like the public health problem it should be. We need to approach this like we did tobacco decades ago. We need to make guns less cool. They're never going to leave our society. We have a Second Amendment. Folks will always be able, I hope, to exercise their Second Amendment right. But we've got to address this as a public health issue and learn about it and then deal with it.
All right, let's go to your calls now. It's 549-2937. Tom is on the West Side. Hello, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning to you, too. I just wanted to say that the shooter in Dayton, he was wearing a bullet-resistant vest that gave him an advantage over the police because he had greater protection. There's no reason for any civilian to have a bullet-resistant vest. It's not protected in the Constitution. They need to be banned. It's just something the criminals use. Someone who's planning a confrontation with law enforcement, and it's something that, that just enables them to kill more people. We don't need these things. They need to go.
All right, Tom, thank you for your call. You know, Daniel, in the last few days, we've heard a lot of rhetoric, particularly from politicians that are on the gun reform side of this issue, saying it's time to ban weapons of war from civilian hands while still protecting the Second Amendment. What about his perspective that the paraphernalia that goes with military grade weapons, does that count as being part of the kind of products that civilians should or shouldn't be able to access?
Well, I mean, legally, if you wanted to follow the Constitution and the interpretations of the courts, yeah, they are definitely things that we could look at as a society, and we could deny citizens access to. You know, to Tom's point, I mean, the bulletproof vests, you know, 30-round magazines or 100-round drums, silencers for, you know, AR-15s and for SKSs and for other guns. I mean, you know, if you want to fire a gun and you want to own one of those guns, you can wear ears or ear protection. You don't need to have a silencer. Why would you want a silencer? I mean, what would be the motivation behind that really for an individual seeking these kinds of things? So what I would say to Tom and other folks who really want to get, you know, the latest interpretation on this is read the late Justice Antonin Scalia. He wrote the majority opinion after the Heller versus the District of Columbia case in 2008, in which he said, while basically saying that we could not ban handguns, which was the D.C. case, which ended up becoming the law of the land, that local and state governments must be given the right to regulate firearms however appropriate for the areas and where they feel is appropriate. We have the ability to get rid or to make it far more difficult to buy this paraphernalia associated with war. The kinds of things that, you know, you would typically see a soldier outfitted in or somebody who was a private contractor. Get rid of these. You know, you can still enjoy an AR-15 or what you want to own and have a 10 magazine clip. You know, or at least apply for a special permit. Go through extraordinary vetting if you want to enjoy that stuff. Right now, they're just too easy to get.
When you look at the statistics around mass shootings, certainly the United States stands alone in the developed world. And it's simply a fact that it is due to the easy availability of these weapons. Other countries have mental illness. They have popular video games. I mean, we've heard these arguments again this over this weekend.
Sure.
But when you look at the data, it simply comes down to the number of guns that we have in this country, more than any other country, and how easy it is to access them. Because we have a constitution that's different than other developed nations. The Second Amendment is so embedded in our cultural life. So what would you say to those listening who think, well, if we allow some of these measures that are now being discussed, then that's a slippery slope to you coming and confiscating my weapons?
Yeah, I would say that that's, you know, not the case. I think that we can draw lines in the sand as a society. I feel like the Second Amendment is not going to be endangered with the situation like the caller with like Tom presented. There are definitely ways that we can better police who's getting firearms and prevent access to these firearms, and also just get rid of things that an honest, legitimate sportsman doesn't need to have. Unless, and I want to be very clear about this, they are willing to go the extra length in our society and submit themselves to further vetting in order to own these. You know, go through a more extensive background check, like the Federal Firearms License Program requires dealers to do. There are ways we can tighten the laws, Melissa, without alienating anybody from the Second Amendment.
And as we talked to Daniel Cronrath of FSCJ, he knows his stuff. He's the former regional director for Mayors Against Illegal Guns. He also completed his doctoral dissertation on the relationship between crime rates and concealed weapons licenses in Florida. We want your opinions, too. Don is on the south side. Hi, Don. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to make a statement and maybe get the comments off the air. But I think that it is not a mental problem. It's an ideology. These people that are doing these mass killings have an ideology. They're not mentally ill. They're pretty screwed up as far as their ideology, but they're mentally sane, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I'll take comments off here.
All right, Don. Thank you for that. You know, we talked about this a minute ago, Daniel. Most of the mass shootings in America are crimes committed by young, disaffected white men. Mm-hmm. Is it time, as some have said over the weekend, to start referring to this as domestic terrorism, as being tied, not all of these incidents, but many of them, tied to a specific ideology?
I think definitely when you look at some and you look at some of the manifestos which are published by some of these shooters, they all have things in common. You know, they all have reference, you know, to various forms of racist ideology, as the caller suggested. I think the other thing to look at, too, I'm trying to figure out this, is that, again, I hate to go back to Columbine, but for a lot of these folks who we find out later, they literally reference Eric Harris, who was the Columbine shooter. He was the original person who, you know, drafted the manifesto. So what a lot of people are speculating now is what you're seeing is a version of riot theory, meaning this is if you have a crowd of people and you all intend or you're rebel rousing, it's going to be one person in that crowd which picks up and throws the first rock. And Eric Harris was the first person to throw that rock. So now you have a bunch of people who are ideologically wired like him. And by the way, in a country of 330 million people, this may only be 330 people. I mean, this can be a very, very small statistical sample. Most gun owners and people out there are responsible. But it only takes a small fringe of individuals to have that kind of radical ideology. And then they look up to a kid like Eric Harris. And of course, something else we talked about off air, Melissa, why do we keep revealing the names of these shooters? Why do we in our society keep rewarding them with the publicity that we don't do this with people who commit suicide. We try to discourage suicide. So why do we keep, you know, talking about, well, what were the motives? And we keep using their names again and again and again. This is what these individuals want to see. They want to somehow go down in lore of their twisted worldview that, you know, they're going to be remembered with this violent action. Let's take away that glory from them.
John on the South Side. Hello, John. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I would just like to say that this is an historical issue that has been going on. We can go all the way back to the 50s and 60s. I mean, the Klan, the white supremacy, nationals have always been violent. They have always killed people. Now we are experiencing it again in the new millennium. And as you all have stated, that this is constantly going on, and it's not a mental ill issue. Okay, you're not mentally ill when you plan to kill people. Okay, but every time this happens, it's branded mentally ill.
Really, John? I mean, like, let me just jump in, John. I hear your point, okay. But at the same time, I do think many of the young men that have done this could certainly be classified as having a mental illness, but I think it's part, there are lots of other issues mixed in with that, if that makes sense. Do you understand my point, John?
Yes, I do understand your point, but at the same time, are we going to say that a quarter percentage of this population is a mental ill population? I mean, our government and the FBI have been watching white supremacy take over the police forces over the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is not something we don't have data on. It's just that the media, when it happens, they play it as if it's a mental ill issue. No, it's not.
I understand your point. Yeah, I get your point.
It's a national issue that we have been dealing with since the 50s.
Thank you, John. Mm-hmm. Okay, the FBI has publicly stated, again after this weekend, that the biggest domestic threat they are now dealing with is white supremacist violent extremism, as the caller pointed out. Mm-hmm. That's not in dispute.
No. No, it's you know, and let me add something, John, because you went there, I think, a little bit in your call, too, just to talk about this issue relative to race. You know, when you look at the state of California in the 1960s, California, a lot of people don't realize this, had open carry. You could carry, just like Texas today, you could carry firearms openly in the state of California. That changed when the Black Panthers marched up and down the streets of Sacramento when Ronald Reagan was governor, and he saw the visual of all of these African Americans who were disenfranchised. They felt like, you know, this is the 60s, obviously it was a civil rights movement. And California changed their laws and then became, under a Republican governor, one of the states with the strongest gun laws in the country. So if you think about that shift, what was the underlying change there? Oh, it's not white people anymore carrying open firearms. It's African Americans carrying open firearms. So this issue of firearms and really not everybody. And again, I hate this. I don't want anybody to listen to this and think I'm painting with a broad brushstroke. But for a lot of folks, the underlying desire and cause to have firearms is associated with fear. And many times that's fear of folks who don't look like us. It's folks from different backgrounds who are coming to our country. And that, I think, going back to your comments before, Melissa, is what's unfortunate about this president, is that right now he's achieving political means by in some ways, sometimes overtly and sometimes very subtly, stoking that fear.
Marilyn in Marineland writes, every time Dayton, Ohio is mentioned about the mass shooting, I cannot believe it happened in my hometown. Me too, Marilyn. That's where I grew up, and I spent a lot of time in the Oregon District as a young adult. She goes on to say, all I'm thinking now is that we need strong leadership from the top down. Trump needs to unite this country. I blame him for his dog whistle approval for the division in our country, she writes. On Facebook, Michelle says, nobody needs a gun that can kill 9 people and wound 27 in less than a minute, unless you were a soldier or on a SWAT team. She's referring to the shooter in Dayton. Dayton PD acted so heroically. They stopped the mass shooting in under a minute. Mm-hmm. But in that 30 to 45 seconds, the shooter there was able to kill 9 people. And here is a tweet from Rob. Besides common sense gun laws, how can we combat the radicalization of young minds on the internet that leads to mass shootings?
That's a great question, Rob. I'm just a humble political scientist who can't answer that question for you. I mean, I wish we had more data. Again, we were talking about going back to the 90s when the CDC was effectively prevented from studying gun violence in the 90s when they wanted to, with something called the Tehart Amendment, which basically linked the funding for the Centers for Disease Control. If they did any kind of research on gun violence, they had their funding threatened every single year. Today, the representative who's out of Congress, Representative Tehart, actually regrets having his name associated with that, because he realizes that the National Rifle Association and the pro-gun crowd literally took 25 years of research that we could have had on this topic, and we don't have it, period. We rely on some think tanks and some efforts that have been done by states like California and other states when we could have been studying. Think about this. Everybody, you know, protecting the Second Amendment while trying to learn the origins of why these folks are the way they are. Wouldn't that be the practical solution? Finding a way to have good Americans keep their guns while understanding why others want to do these kinds of heinous crimes? That in my mind is the solution, but we're not there.
There have been calls meanwhile to shut down the website 8chan,
yeah,
which has become a forum for extremist discussion. The El Paso shooter posted a manifesto there, mm-hmm, right before he went and killed people in Walmart.
Sure. And by the way, we need to come up with a solution to this, because America is going to be becoming more multicultural, not less. We know that America, as more and more Latinos and other groups come into the United States, we know that our demographic projections are, as by, I think, by the year 2040, that white America will be a majority minority in this country. So if you're already somebody who's wound up tightly about relative to, and you're a white supremacist and you have these views, this country is only going to continue to become more multicultural, no matter how much we may want to make America great again and go back to a simpler time. And a lot of course, even, and I'm not quoting this, you know, Leader Pelosi in the House has said that she hears make America white again coming out of this president quite often. That's only going to stoke up and ramp people who have a deep-seated problem. It's only going to make the situation worse.
I think that's why the nation is on edge. Fear of multiculturalism, anxiety about it, and sometimes outright racism.
Sometimes.
Not always, but
nope.
Sometimes.
Nope.
Is what's driving violence and division, yeah, right now. In America.
I think a lot of it's an education too, an education issue too. I think the more that you take folks from other cultures and you mix them with folks who have been here and they get the opportunity to talk and know them as people, a lot of times you can educate and you can expose people away from that kind of fear and that kind of ignorance, you know, really about, you know, all the wonderful things that we have in common. If you take anybody from another culture and you bring them, Melissa, 98% of the things, even if it's not a language, we have in common: food, family, fun, sports, liking to read. You know, all of these things we're bound together by humans, but we tend to just blow up and exaggerate the small amount of differences we have. And sadly, right now, it's being used as a political tool.
Always good to get your political insights. Thank you for being here this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Melissa.
Daniel Cronrath of FSCJ. And up next, help and support for local veterans. They're dealing with the long-term health impacts of Agent Orange. How you can access resources in Jacksonville about that this week. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Well, a town hall looking at the effects of Agent Orange is happening this Wednesday on UNF's campus. Agent Orange was a tactical herbicide used by the military throughout the 1960s and up till 1975. It was named for the orange band around the storage barrel. Now, the military sprayed millions of gallons of the stuff on trees and vegetation during the Vietnam War. And so there's a whole range of diseases for veterans and their descendants associated with exposure to Agent Orange. If that means you need to come to this town hall, learn about potential claims and other resources you can access. Here with more, we're pleased to welcome retired U.S. Navy Captain Bob Buen. He's UNF's Military and Veterans Resource Center Director. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks.
Thanks for being with us. Also in studio, Char Miller. She's Director of Marketing and Communications with Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Good to see you, Char.
Good morning, Melissa.
All right, Bob, let's begin with you. There's a large veteran community here, and certainly many of them or their children or grandchildren have been impacted by Agent Orange. Let's explain the scope of the problem first. What do we know about the percentage of folks in Florida that are dealing with this?
Well, and you know, that's the percentage is really unknown, and that's part of our purpose is of the town hall is to get information out for people who don't realize, one, that they may have a benefit coming, or two, that they the illness that their Vietnam vet or veteran from another era is experiencing could be associated with this Agent Orange. So the numbers are bigger than we realize, but we know there are many, many Vietnam vets still with us who are demonstrating or manifesting these illnesses, and we want to connect them with their benefits. Really, that's our purpose.
Right. There are benefits available, Char, for veterans and their families, correct?
Absolutely. So Vietnam Veterans of America is coming in from Washington, D.C., and we also have all of their materials on hand. We'll also have City of Jacksonville and all the different surrounding counties. Their veteran service officers will be in attendance to help with claims and file claims. There's a panel of experts there to help as well. And the keynote speaker, really the catalyst for Bob and I behind organizing this, is Tony DeLeo. And Tony is the local chapter president for Vietnam Veterans of America 1046. And he's living with cancer, which has riddled the inside of his body.
He has cancer throughout his body. His granddaughter has spina bifida, and you believe that was caused by Agent Orange. How does it pass down through different generations?
Well, they call this a five-generation disease, and maybe it's beyond that. Maybe it's seven. We don't know yet. But you're right. Tony's granddaughter has spina bifida, and that has been associated through the VA and other medical experts with exposure to Agent Orange. So we know that was the cause of it, but it's kind of mysterious, one of those DNA things, how that all happens. Mm-hmm. But the correlation has been made for sure. And in fact, those kind of people may be have benefits for them as well.
How culpable is the military today? At what point did they realize Agent Orange was a carcinogen? And then they kept using it for a while, didn't they?
They did. And that's a subject for debate. But Monsanto was kind of the primary producer of this stuff. And it's pretty clear that they knew much sooner than anybody announced that this was toxic to people. But the poor folks in Vietnam, the troops were told it was harmless, and so they handled it like almost like it was barrels of water.
And it was being used. Let's explain why
it was used. Yeah, it's a very simple concept. The idea was if we destroy all the vegetation, then there's nowhere for the enemy to hide. So it was, sprayed from aircraft and also from trucks, all in huge, extensive areas. And this is another whole issue, is the what's left over in Vietnam today. It's even more devastating there.
That's the tragedy for veterans and their families, Char. Not only were so many young men scarred by their wartime experience, then they came home and learned they were sick because of this product that was used. And now their families still today have illness.
Right. And actually, Bob and I were sitting talking last week with a friend of his named Bill, and we were discussing presumptive conditions and other effects of this defolant. And he said, oh, my goodness, my first wife miscarried two children. And to which Tony DeLeo said, I think that you could have actually Agent Orange, and do you have any other symptoms? So there was some healing going on in that moment. So that's what we want to happen this Wednesday from 9 to 12 at UNF, is healing and resources and education for people who are living with these conditions, and especially their loved ones, to help them get the resources that they need.
And what are resources? What resources are available to them?
Right. So there is an Agent Orange registry. So we're going to share that information. The panel will discuss their specific expertise. So we have Vietnam Veterans of America is attending. They're on the panel along with the city of Jacksonville. Our local VA will be there. The Mobile Vet Center from the Veterans Administration will be there. And then the service officers will help them file claims with the VA if they determine that they have presumptive conditions.
People might need the help because the bureaucracy can be overwhelming, right?
Absolutely.
To even begin the process?
Well, it's probably mind-boggling to begin the process, much less just this gentleman just the other day said, oh, I think I could have it. So there are people, I believe the number was over 800,000, 880,000 are still remaining from the war, living from the war, and there are over 80,000 that are just registered with VVA.
Yeah, and that number, Melissa, is those who are on the ground in Vietnam.
Right.
And this thing has expanded now to include sailors on ships at sea that handled it, and in ports, and even in other countries in the States here. So that's why we think the numbers are much bigger. The 830 or 880,000 still alive who served on the ground in Vietnam is just part of the number.
So there could be some guys out there who really have no idea that they are eligible for this kind of support. Is that right? Yes.
That's right. If you served on a Navy ship or loaded aircraft with this, or flew in an aircraft that had sprayed it, there's just all kinds of ways this, or if you drank the water or ate the food in those countries, I mean, it got in the aquifer, it got in the food, it was there pervasive.
Are you a Vietnam veteran?
I am not. I did not come into the Navy till 1978, so
okay.
I'm not a Vietnam vet.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, how the after effects, the ripple effects of this continue to reverberate through our culture and the harm that was caused. And why don't we take a moment, going beyond the town hall, to talk about the resources you provide at UNF for veterans.
We have the Military and Veterans Resource Center at UNF, serves the roughly 1,400 what we call military-affiliated students that go there. That includes family members that can get the GI Bill, active duty, that whole range of folks. But that's a pretty big number of our overall population of about 18,000. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a center that the university has really made a commitment to putting a great spot right in the middle of campus in Founders Hall. And it's there for all the vets and all those people that are military affiliated. We offer a place where they can come study. There's computers. There's a kitchen there they can use. There's lockers. So we have a steady stream as we're about to start fall here on August 19th. We'll see a crowd of folks in there every day, all day long.
Sure. And Char, let's take a minute to give some kudos to the amazing work of Community Hospice.
Very kind of you. We've been around since 1979 and we've served veterans since 1979. So it's our passion to take care of them. And on any given day, we serve 1,600 patients, and that doesn't include their family and loved ones. So we serve several thousand people a day in 16 counties, and it's always been our mission to take care of people at the end of life.
Sure. And so many veterans in this community, you know, I hope that there are folks out there listening that they're hearing this information for the first time, and they'll be motivated to access this help and support. If you're just tuning in, we are talking about an Agent Orange Town Hall. It is going to be happening Wednesday, August 7th, from 9 a.m. to noon at the Herbert University Center on the UNF campus. You can register and get your ticket at Eventbrite and come to this, because not only will you get a lot of information, you will get the kind of help you need to access resources going beyond claims that veterans can file with the government. Bob, what else will be on tap for veterans to access in the way of support?
Well, we'll have, as Char mentioned, we'll have veteran service officers there. So, you know, once the idea of the workshop is we'll kind of set the stage. Here's the history of the problem, and then here's some of the how it manifests itself. And so somebody sitting there could actually walk over and sit down with a veteran service officer and say, you know, I think I might be affected by this. I might have a claim, and actually start the claim right there. So that's our goal, is to get the word out and then not just leave it at that, but lead them to somebody who can help for the VA.
And how many claims is the VA processing each year? And how likely is it that they'll actually see money or insurance coverage or whatever it is that they need?
Well, there's tens of thousands of claims, but you know, VA, Char mentioned the registry that exists. It's already presumed if you served in Vietnam and many other places during a set time period that you were exposed. So that's not an issue you have to prove anymore. Then there's a list of more than a dozen presumptive conditions, illnesses, Parkinson's, ischemic heart disease, some respiratory cancers, all that kind of thing, that if you have that, it's presumed then to be caused by the exposure to Agent Orange. So you would get VA care for that.
And then also take a moment to think about your children and grandchildren. They could be, you might not even realize, but they could be affected too.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah,
absolutely, Melissa. So that's the important part, is maybe someone attends or a loved one attends or a neighbor attends, and they go back and have a conversation with someone who served in Vietnam. And you can see that they can lead them on to maybe understanding that they could have this presumptive condition, they could file a claim, and there's hope. So we really just want to provide an event that's educational and provides resources and hope.
So go to Eventbrite and look for the Agent Orange Town Hall. This is presented by Community Hospice and UNF's Military and Veterans Resource Center. An Agent Orange Town Hall this Wednesday, kicking off at 9 a.m. at the Herbert Center on the UNF campus. Register now. Tickets are free.
Absolutely. Free of charge.
So take advantage of this. If you are a Vietnam veteran or your loved one served in Vietnam, there will be a lot here in the way of help, support, and processing of potential claims. Thank you so much, retired U.S. Navy Captain Bob Buen. He heads up UNF's Military and Veterans Resource Center. And Char Miller, Director of Marketing Communications at Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Again, that's Wednesday. Well, up next, a big pickup for the Jaguars as they start training camp. Cole Pepper runs that down for us, along with some other sports news and notes, right after this here on First Coast Connect. Keep listening.
By the time today's babies are 80 years old, the sea is projected to have risen up to 6.6 feet. So what's being done to protect life on the First Coast? On ADAPT from WJCT, you'll find stories about adaptation by everyone from the Navy to realtors and the City of Jacksonville. Join us now at adaptflorida.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Terry talks to filmmaker Rodney Evans. He's lost much of his vision, but he's still making movies. His new documentary, Vision Portraits, is about how he and three other blind or visually impaired artists, a writer, a dancer, and a photographer, continue to do their work. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The large format black and white photographs of Clyde Butcher document Florida's natural environment. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Clyde Butcher. We'll discuss Jacksonville in the 1880s and have a conversation with influential feminist Judith Kaplan. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Christine Lagarde is off to run the European Central Bank, but the guy left behind running the IMF? Oh, he's plenty busy. I think we have some more work to do with new tariffs announced recently. It's really important to keep the global economy growing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The global economy waits for no one. You know, that's next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson. The news is often confusing, but not always.
Women are better leaders.
We're not afraid of nuance, but we are happy to hear from guests who just tell it like it is.
From an economic standpoint, if you don't have gender balance, you are stupid.
1A, always available in plain English. Weekdays from WAMU and NPR.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, the Jaguars get Yannick Ngakoue back in camp just in time for the team's trip to Baltimore.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
All right, will there be a deal for the Jaguars pass rusher? And what else is going on with training camp? Cole Pepper is here with some sports. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, no deal yet for Yannick Ngakoue. As things stand right now, he will play for his $2 million contract for this season. It's the last year of his rookie deal. Ngakoue ended his holdout yesterday, and for the first time in camp, he practiced with the rest of the Jaguars. It was a short practice in the indoor facility with the Jaguars practicing a shorter practice, and Ngakoue certainly wasn't limited at all. He did have a chance to greet his teammates, many of whom he'd been in constant contact with throughout the course of the 11-day holdout. But no new deal. So what happens next now? Well, as I mentioned, he could just play this season at his $2 million number and then hope to become a free agent after the season. But if he does that, the Jaguars could always retain him, not allow him to get to free agency, by putting the franchise tag on him, which this year is $17 million and change. Not bad money. It was reported, by the way, that Ngakoue was offered a $19 million a year deal. Ngakoue tweeted a response to somebody who had tweeted at him, not to believe everything you read. Hmm. Now, that's not an outright denial, but it's sort of a non-denial denial.
Non-denial denial sounds like all the president's men.
Right. It's a non-denial denial that it actually was a deal that was offered. So we'll see how it all plays out. The Jaguars have to keep in mind, though, that they have some other stars that they're going to have to sign new contracts. Jalen Ramsey's deal has this year and next year remaining on it. Usually you don't want your big star players going into the last year of a contract because that means they have an opportunity to perhaps leave you without you signing them, unless you, again, want to use one of those franchise tags or transitional tags, which can wind up costing you quite a bit. I think it's more likely that the two sides are going to come to an agreement before the start of the season. Mm-hmm. It is in the Jaguars' best interest, remember, to wait as long as they can to sign Ngakoue, because what if a key player goes down with an injury or Telvin Smith decides he's not going to play this year? All of a sudden, you've got to fill the gap somehow. Now, the amount of money that you have available under the salary cap typically is not going to be so much that it would to keep you from signing somebody late in the process, because most of the time at that point, those aren't big star players who are out there and available. But we'll see how it all plays out. Ngakoue is definitely a valuable player for the Jaguars at a premium position. You talk about a guy who rushes the passer, has been durable and reliable, and he's just 24 years old. The Jaguars should sign him. They need to be careful not to sign him at the risk of losing other big players. But they got to get the deal done.
They got to get it done. Meanwhile, they will be working out on the field this week with the Ravens in Baltimore. Tell us about that.
They left last night for Baltimore. This is the same kind of thing the Jaguars have done in the past with teams like the Patriots and last year the Minnesota Vikings. It's 2 days, today and tomorrow, working on the field and combined practices and training camp. Then they'll have a day off Wednesday before the preseason opener. On Thursday, the Jaguars' first preseason home game is a week from Thursday here in Jacksonville against the Philadelphia Eagles.
Yeah. Already. My gosh.
You know, and it's funny, once you hit this time of year in my line of work, you've got college football starting up. All the teams have begun practice now. The Gators have been practicing for an extra week because they're playing a week zero game against Miami to open the season. The high school football teams are out and practicing. We've been out at practices this week. So it is definitely football season in Jacksonville.
Okay, let's talk about what you want to see in the preseason opener.
All right, I'd like to see Nick Foles lead the team downfield for a couple of touchdowns. He's not going to be in the game long, but Foles so far has looked very accurate. And as we mentioned last week on the show, teammates have been raving about his leadership. So I would like to see Foles march the team downfield, a couple of touchdowns, or at least a touchdown and a field goal. Get him out of there, let him sit, and watch what happens the rest of the way, and we'll see how the backups perform. I also want to see the offensive line control the line of scrimmage. This is the toughest thing to gauge in training camp because in this day and age, they don't go full speed very often. Maybe a little bit on goal line situations, something like that in practice, but I'd like to see how that group works. Remember, they're still without Cam Robinson. The starting left tackle has been held out because he's coming back from knee surgery, and he'd like to see what happens on the right side with Juwan Taylor, the rookie, whether he gets any snaps with the first team. Speaking of rookies, I'd like to see Josh Allen rush the passer. He's looked very good in practice. You can see the natural ability, the athletic ability he's got. Let's see him put it together on the field against somebody else wearing a different jersey. And finally, I'd like to see some wide receivers make some plays. This is the most interesting position group battle going on right now. See who's going to develop and to sort of rise to the top of this wide receiver group.
All right. Last but not least, let's talk about the Sharks.
Yeah, they have begun preparations for tomorrow night's playoff game here in Jacksonville at the arena. They'll take on the Columbus Lions. The Sharks are the number one seed in the National Arena League. They've won 13 straight games. They lost the opener and then won out, and they're two wins away from winning the NAL championship.
Well, good luck to them, and thank you, as always, for being here every Monday with us, and catch Cole every night on our news partner, Channel 4, the local station. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. Don't miss tomorrow's show as we speak with author Mike Tolbert about Jake, his new biography on former Jacksonville mayor Jake Godbold. That's tomorrow. That's going to be a good one, don't you think?
A lot of personality.
Yeah, I'm hearing that former Mayor Godbold might call in, so we'll have to listen for that. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with us. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.